In the name of God, who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. When I rashly came up with the sermon title, The Future of Truth, it already risked being portentous, and that was before I knew it would be my last major sermon here, freight upon freight. Still, it can feel like we are careering into an ever deeper disorientation, in the so-called West at least, into a world where truth, by which I really mean truthfulness and truth-telling, and objectivity are in retreat. In much of the news media, story or sensation or political point scoring trump truthfulness. In politics, the appeal is to prejudice or greed or fear, not to the kindness and generosity which a truthful analysis of society and its needs might encourage. In religion, especially Christianity, simplistic, exclusive dogmatism outshouts the humble hope which a truthful sense of the divine and of divine love demands. And in all of them, people often don't seem to be saying what they really mean. But the problem isn't new. 3,000 years ago, as we heard in the first lesson, that most horrible story, Israel's most famous king arranges a certain death for the husband of the woman he has violated. It's a murderous act motivated by mendacity and deceit. Then 500 years later, the prophet Isaiah has his head in his hands and says, "Justice is turned back, and righteousness stands at a distance, for truth stumbles in the public square, and uprightness cannot enter. Truth is lacking, and whoever turns from evil is despoiled." Happily, Isaiah also foresaw that God would do something about it, and I will come back to this, but we need to spend more time in the tunnel before we dare look to the light. So it's going to be dark for a few more minutes yet. How is truth stumbling today? Well, let's take those three areas I mentioned, the media, politics, and religion. They're all vast and variegated areas, so I can only highlight a feature or two in each. In the media, not just social media, it gets ever harder to know what to believe. And so the serious news outlets now have fact-checking operations, like BBC Verify. We need them, as we've always needed, good journalists, to test the veracity of what public figures or institutions are saying. And that veracity is going to be about more than factual accuracy. It also includes honesty about how your vested interests or personal agendas are at work in the background. This is vital if we're going to keep faith in the trustworthiness of our own systems and those who run them or want to. It also really matters in how we view crisis situations elsewhere in the world. And if we want to take truth and truthfulness properly seriously, that means trying to discover the facts of the matter and in the most objective terms possible. But this can be incredibly difficult to articulate. Take the Israel-Palestine conflict, one of the most challenging in this respect. You should be able to say, "I have done my best to learn the history of the situation, and I can see how and why the conflict has developed. I don't for an instant condone horrific violence, whether done by terrorist or soldier, but I can see why it's happening." If you can't say something like that, then truth stumbles very badly. And without such truth-telling, the possibility of reconciliation recedes. Desmond Tutu taught us this. Sometimes the truth or truthfulness of a situation is hidden behind what we actually hear said. As I get even older, I get more skeptical, more alert to what people really mean, not be distracted by what they're actually saying. Certainly applies in politics. Take, for example, the contemporary debate and campaign rhetoric over immigration. Virtually all politicians, or those of the major parties at least, often begin by saying, well, of course, we all know we need to control immigration. But they don't say what they mean by that. And they don't say why. It risks looking like a dog whistle to xenophobia, otherwise known as racism, when a factual, let alone ethical, analysis of the situation would be a great deal more constructive and truthful. You can see similar disingenuousness in the religious sphere, sad to say. Here's a very niche example, but I saw it happening. It was in the Synod of the Church of England, and they were discussing how the next Archbishop of Canterbury would be appointed, as to say, who would be on the key panel. It's called the Crown Nominations Commission. And the idea being mooted was to have more representation from the worldwide Anglican Communion. Some supported the proposal by saying that it was more democratic and less colonialist. But what they actually meant was that they'd love some anti-LGBT bishops from the Communion, of whom there are plenty, to help push their conservative line here by loading the commission in that direction. Others objected on the basis that the Archbishop is first and foremost the Primate of England, so it'd be better to have a more diverse representation from the Church of England in the process. And in any case, conversely, the idea of the Archbishop having a growing leadership role in the wider communion is actually itself rather colonialist. Now, as it happens, their worries about lingering colonialism were probably right. But what they actually meant was that they feared that some anti-LGBT bishops from the communion might help push the conservative line here. It all presented as an argument about democracy or colonialism or governance, but it was actually about something else, and everybody there knew that. Then we need to dig a bit deeper. In all three of these contexts, the very language we hear matters. Banality, cliche, and fake simplicity are not just stylistic matters. They pose real risks, nor are they new problems. They've inspired some powerful and prophetic pushback in the last almost 100 years. And this has taken some interestingly divergent forms. On the one hand, you have George Orwell. He argues in Politics in the English Language for a radical simplification of language, for a purification of how we speak and write, especially in politics, so that ill-intentioned politicians can't distract us with their rhetoric. He writes, "When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms, like a cuttlefish squirting out ink." Conversely, writers and thinkers like the poet Geoffrey Hill, the spiritual writer Thomas Merton, Rowan Williams, all make the case for complexity, even apparent difficulty. The truth of things, especially important and complicated things, importantly need complicated analysis. Otherwise, we're left with simplistic, sloganeering language, which can be dangerous. So Rowan Williams writes in 2015, and sounds like an Old Testament prophet, "If we talk and write badly, dishonestly, unanswerably, what we are actually doing is getting ready for war. The habits of mind that make war inevitable are the habits of bad language. That is to say, the habits that grow from uncritical attitudes to power and privilege, contempt towards the powerless, towards minorities, towards the stranger, the longing for an end to human complexity and difference." Those who balk at analytical complexity are less interested in being truthful and more interested in just being believed, or even perhaps being obeyed. A critical irony in this is that the conjunction of such debased language with what people are actually experiencing in their lives can lead to dangerous disenchantment and cynicism. It's different from skepticism. It doesn't matter whether we're hearing cliche, I've always been clear, or something more sinister, the dangers which threaten us. A British social attitude survey published only last Wednesday includes these three findings, amongst others. 45% would almost never trust British governments of any party to place the needs of the nation above the interests of their own political party. 58% would almost never trust politicians of any party in Britain to tell the truth when they're in a tight corner. 72% of those who are struggling financially almost never trust politicians. That compares with 49%, just 49%, of those living comfortably. All that risks creating a void into which the worst of demagoguery and nationalism can step. When healthy skepticism gives way to corrosive cynicism, that is a danger far worse than anything brandished before us by manipulative politicians. But, enough bleak Jeremiah. It's not all like that, of course, by any means. There is plenty to relish and admire and enjoy in life, in the media, in religion, even in politics. But there's enough like that to need to call it out. So as I said a wee while back, there is light as well as tunnel. There absolutely is light and hope. And Isaiah, who had those excoriating things to say about truth stumbling in the public square, went on to say he had a hunch. The Lord saw it and it displeased him that there was no justice. He saw that there was no one and was appalled that there was no one to intervene. So his own arm brought him victory and his righteousness upheld him. God did intervene himself in the person of Jesus. When it feels like we're in a tunnel, that's the light that can see us out. Jesus was not only passionate about truth, he said he is the truth. I am the way and the truth and the life. He doesn't say, I'm telling you the truth. He says, I am the truth. That tells us that everything he says and does and the way he says and does them and what he means and what he achieves and who he is, all these are the embodiment of truth. It's who he is. And so our best hope of ensuring that truth has a future is to give our full loving attention to the incarnation of truth, which is Jesus. This means that we will share Isaiah's prophetic recognition that truth stumbles when justice and righteousness are missing. Truth is an ethical concept. This is very different from talking about the truth, as though there were a neatly definable set of propositions to which we have to assent as good Christians. That just weaponizes the idea of truth. That can be dogmatic and excluding and even hard-hearted. It's the sort of Christianity which has never forgiven God for the incarnation. Jesus, God incarnate, God made human, is the human that God became because he thought being human was so brilliant. And of course he thought that. It was his idea. Those of you who have had to listen to me over your time here, never before at such length, have heard me say that before many times, that I am unrepentant. I really do believe that the foundation of all that is true and beautiful and good is the truth that is Jesus. Jesus is the one we want to be like, to be with, and to meet finally face to face in whatever lies beyond death for every single one of us. Jesus is the one who looks into our eyes through the eyes of every person we meet or say, saying, "What are you going to do for me?" Jesus is the one whose spirit is trying to drag us deeper and deeper into the truth of things. We should let ourselves be dragged. Then truth has a future that we will be part of making, a truth that is true to the best of our being human, a future that we can look forward to with real, well-grounded hope.